Hi, I'm Sally Hughes, and this is the return of Beyond the Bathroom, where each week I find out how my guests feel about their own appearance. What kind of relationship do they have with their own face and body? What are their go-to beauty routines? Are they obsessive about their appearance, or is it low on their list of priorities? And how have time and experience changed the way they feel about the way they look? I'm so excited because bearing all today is one of my dearest friends, Sam Chapman. If you use YouTube or have even a passing interest in beauty, you'll likely have seen one of Sam's tutorials or used one of her original Real Techniques brushes. As one half of the Pixie Woo brand with younger sister Nick, Sam achieved over 1 billion views for her creative but clear and calm videos and has amassed over 1 million followers on Instagram. Though despite a life spent teaching women how to best apply makeup, she says she most likes people who just chuck it on. So Sam, I have chucked on my face this morning, especially for you. But before that, a massive thank you to our wonderful series sponsor, Skin & Me. Skin & Me is your most accessible, fast track to simplified skincare, offering powerful active ingredients in formulations you can't buy on the high street. Skin & Me can create a treatment for your specific skin concerns, tailored to you by experts. Whether you want to target adult acne, pigmentation, melasma, rosacea, or skin aging, this is powerful, personalized skincare that truly works. As someone who has used Skin & Me for years, I can honestly say I wouldn't go without it. Later in this series, I'm delighted to say we'll be joined by one of Skin & Me's very own dermatologists to answer any and all of your pressing skincare questions. Now, on to today's episode of Beyond the Bathroom. Welcome.
You have not. You look amazing.
I did chuck on my face on the train, on a crowded train. I never, ever, ever get to the train station with makeup on, which means I always then see somebody.
Yes.
When I look like a right old dog.
Same. I did my entire makeup on the train. My train journey was 2 hours and I did it from start to finish. I took my time. I really do enjoy doing my makeup. It's just a nice little escape, isn't it?
I do too. Are you a train watcher? So when I see a woman putting on her makeup on the train, I am obsessed. I can barely take my eyes off her.
I love it until they bring out a Real Techniques brush. And then I'm like, this is slightly awkward and embarrassing, isn't it? But yeah, I mean, it's great. I love it. I love people that take chances with makeup.
Yes,
I love watching women put makeup on with their fingers. And, you know, you learn so much from watching how other people do it.
I so agree. I never, ever, ever think, oh, you're doing that wrong.
Never.
I just think, oh, you're doing it like that. Oh, and sometimes I think, oh, I might do it like
Absolutely.
That and see what happens.
I see products other people are using and I'm like, oh, that looks good. I think I might go and buy that.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. A woman doing a makeup on a shaky tube as well. I'm just like, I'm in awe. Even I don't do that very often when it's kind of hammering between stations. I'm so chuffed to have you here. I've had you on a previous podcast series and it was a very, very different series. I didn't find it difficult at all, but it was different because I know you so well in real life. And I think you're such a kind of deep person. And I really wanted this opportunity to just kind of talk to you really about you. Because I think as beautiful an artist as you are, that's the bit I love about you. So tell me what your earliest, if you can recall, beauty memory is.
I mean, I remember looking at my mum thinking that she was beautiful always.
And she is.
She is.
She still is.
Absolutely. I remember her using blue eyeliner. But my earliest beauty memory actually is all the furore around whether Boy George was a girl or a boy, which is such a funny one to remember because I probably was 6 or 7 or maybe 8. And I remember it was so huge. Is he a boy? Is he a girl? I was like, his name's Boy. He's obviously a boy wearing makeup. What's the issue with that? And I just was so baffled by how stupid people were.
I remember that like it was yesterday.
Yeah.
So it was, do you really want to hurt me?
It was.
And he was on Top of the Pops. And I was at the end of primary school, I think. And I got into school the next day and it was literally all anybody could talk about.
That's it. I can remember it in the playground.
Yeah.
That's the memory I have.
Yeah. It was huge, wasn't it?
You can't even possibly imagine how big that news was and how bizarre it is in today's day and age.
It was... I mean, the word is bandied about, but I really think it's justified here. It was an iconic beauty moment, wasn't it?
It was, absolutely.
And how did you, as little Sam, feel about it when you saw him?
I was just really excited. I thought he was great and colourful and fun. And I felt like he appealed to young me, and he was colourful and very enjoyable to watch. That's as much as I can really remember. I loved that song.
Yeah.
I loved the way he dressed. I just found it exciting.
See, that's not surprising to me that you've been like, oh, well, I felt like he was for me, or I felt like it spoke to me, because you love the madness of beauty, don't you?
I love it.
You love the creativity and the bonkersness of beauty. Did you at that point think, oh, maybe I could do that?
I think that was my first experience with using makeup to express an identity.
Right.
Which I think is probably something that I come back to a lot with the stuff that I do. You know, I rarely wear the same makeup 2 days in a row.
Right.
It just depends what face I'm putting on that day and who I'm seeing and who I want to be, what I want to tell the world about myself. And I think that maybe that was really my first experience with thinking, oh, it's so transformational. It's not just about making someone look pretty, because you could make yourself look fierce or, you know, gender neutral or wherever you want to go. I mean, obviously we didn't use those terms back then, but it was totally fine for you to do any of those things. It just got a bit weird in the 2000s, I think. But back when I was a kid, it was super interesting.
And did you think you were pretty, or were you just not aware?
I didn't ever think about it. I didn't think about it at all, which seems peculiar considering the job that I then went into. Even though I ended up putting makeup on my own face, I've always preferred putting it on other people's face. And as you know, I'm actually quite a quiet, shy person.
Yeah.
So you've probably been chasing me for quite a while to do these podcasts and things like that. But I do tend to avoid things.
Yeah.
I'm just not a greatly social creature in that respect. I've completely fallen the question and gone off tangent. This is what happens.
Well, no, I don't think you've gone off on a tangent, because I think that's relevant, because my question really was how you felt about yourself as a person, either on the outside or the in. I don't feel like I'm crossing a line here, because you've been very open about the fact that your childhood was not sweetness and light and roses.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering how you felt as a person and your place in the world, and were you always quiet?
I think I was always quiet, but when we talk about myself, it's very hard for me to put myself in a place where I think about myself, because at that time I thought about, I'm getting quite emotional. I'm totally fine, everyone. I spent a lot of time thinking about other people at that time in my life. So I didn't think, I mean, that would have been so trivial to think, am I pretty or not?
Yeah.
And also because there were so many mind games in my house, just in case anyone doesn't know, my dad was very violent. So, and also kind of psychopathic, really, because there were so many mind games in my house, I didn't ever think about myself like that. And I spent an awful lot of time in my room hiding.
Right. Yeah.
So
trying to stay out of trouble.
Just staying out of the way, you know, so I didn't have to absorb that. So I don't know. I think I probably am naturally quite quiet, but that made me more insular.
Also, you're the big girl, right?
Yes.
And that's classic of the eldest child. When there's stuff going on at home, you have to kind of put your feelings away because you've got loads of siblings and a mum to look after.
Yes, exactly.
You know, it's quite common to have that slightly codependent relationship with the victimised or aggrieved parent, where you feel like you've got to put them first and your feelings don't really matter because you've got to put your big girl pants on.
I think that's exactly what happened. So I never really thought about it. And I remember the first time someone besides my mum or dad, not really my dad, but I remember the first time someone said that I was pretty. I was in the first year of high school and there were some fifth year boys who said, you're going to be really pretty when you grow up. And I was really obviously mortified, so embarrassed. I'd not thought about that. And I wasn't even in the realms of thinking about boys, you know, at that time. But
also, I think if you're trying not to be noticed, if your job at home is to keep a low profile, to be noticed in the outside world can be quite shocking and can be quite unsettling.
Yes, I'm still the same now.
Yeah,
I don't like it. You know exactly what I'm like.
Yeah.
I mean, I rarely go to events, and I'll only go to an event if there's somebody there who I know. So if you're there or my sister's there, I know I'm in a safe space.
Yeah.
But I mean, Sal will tell you, I'm critically awkward in social situations.
Yeah.
I cannot do small talk at all. So I do tend to avoid those things as much as possible. And I've always been that way. I've never really liked the attention, which seems so peculiar because of the job that I then went on to do and all of the people that probably think I'm not at all like that.
Yeah.
But when you think about it, I'm just in a room with myself when I do those things.
Yeah. And people think the same about me, I'm sure. And I'm much more like you than I am like what they imagine.
Let's pause this conversation briefly to thank our brilliant series sponsor, Skin & Me. Filled with active ingredients, Skin & Me products streamline your routine and maximise your results, making it excellent value. Getting into a skincare routine is also a great way to ensure you take some time for yourself every single day. No matter how busy my days get, I make sure I wind down and really enjoy my Skin & Me moment. Everyone deserves to feel good in their own skin, and Skin & Me are here to make that happen. Their highly effective formulations won't be found on the high street and use active ingredients that work to repair, rebuild, and reinforce your skin barrier on a cellular level. If you've been struggling with your skin recently, I'd really recommend you try Skin & Me. Skin & Me aren't your usual skincare brand. Every single consultation and photo set you submit is personally reviewed by an expert dermatology clinician. Your personalized formulation is then made to order and evolves each month as your skincare journey progresses. Plus, you'll have regular check-ins with the dermatology team to monitor your progress, and you'll have access to expert advice whenever you need it. Because Skin & Me's formulations are effective, you don't need a complicated routine with countless products. Just a simplified regime that saves you money. Try your first month of personalized treatment from Skin & Me for $4.99 instead of the usual $24.99. Just visit skinandme.com and use the code SALLYANDME to get started.
I want to come back to the social media thing. Before that, you were, and I say this with absolute admiration and love because I was also one of these. I say this is the highest form of respect. You were a shop girl. You worked in a shop.
I was, yes.
And so you left your blood family and became part of what I know is another kind of family. Yeah. When you work in retail, you all earn bugger all.
Yes.
And you work silly hours and you are together for an extremely large amount of time per week. And it was in beauty, which by this point, what you had acquired skills, you'd been experimenting. I know beauty was in the family.
Yep.
Anyway, so tell me how that came about and what that meant and how that affected how you were as a person.
Again, we have to go back to the dad thing. So when we finally escaped that situation, my mum ended up living with my two brothers that are 10 years younger than me and my sister in her friend's house. There was no space for me. I mean, they would have found space for me, but there wasn't really. And so when I was 17, I moved to London and lived in Walthamstow and lived with my mum's brother for a period of time. So I had to get a job. And I got a job in a store. I must have been just 18. And then I just moved around stores until I ended up at MAC. And I started at MAC, I think in the, maybe it was autumn 98. I started off in the King's Road store, which I really liked. But I always wanted to be in Soho because when I had gone up to London previously, the Soho store was the most exciting.
Yeah.
It was always the most exciting. Yeah. I mean, you had to pluck up courage to go into that store. Everybody looked so, I mean, they were obviously
prohibitively cool.
So cool and so interesting. And obviously I came from Norwich, which is at that time was not very multicultural, was not very, you know, like not even gay friendly, but I mean, you just didn't. It was very straight, you know, and so I was really excited about the Soho store. And also they didn't work weekends. So when I got the opportunity
did
to...
Did they not?
They didn't. Back then, no.
So I was round the corner at Gap on Regent
Were
Street.
Were you?
Yeah. And I remember that Newburgh store so, so well. And I don't think I ever clocked that it wasn't open on the weekends.
Yeah, because...
I mean, that's a
then,
dream scenario.
It was amazing. If you think about it, back then, Carnaby Street was just kind of souvenir shops and vintage stores,
yeah.
Right? There was nothing
yeah.
else down there. And Newburgh Street with this little hidden street with all these cool little independent stores,
yeah.
completely different now. But all these little independent stores, apart from the MAC store, which even then...
Wasn't
even
a big player.
It wasn't
yeah.
a big player, even though it was still owned by Estee Lauder, just, but it was, but it wasn't a big player at all. So it was such an exciting place to work. Also, I've never been the biggest fan of the King's Road. I never felt like I really fitted in down there. So I wanted to be somewhere that felt, I mean, I would have loved the King's Road in the 60s.
You know my thoughts on Chelsea and
yes.
Knightsbridge, Sam.
Yes.
You know, let's
yes.
not even go there.
We connect on a lot of things,
yeah.
that one in particular.
Yeah.
So yeah, when I got the chance to move to Soho, I absolutely jumped at it. And I'm still friends with everybody I worked with.
Yeah. So, I mean, for some context, if any of our listeners are big beauty fans, which I assume you probably are, you know, we're talking about people like Cher Webb and, yeah, and Terry Barber and later on your sister and people who are still really prominent in the industry. What kind of training was it? Why do you think that is?
I think that MAC drew a lot of hyper creative people that didn't feel like they fit in a standard kind of, I suppose, House of Fraser, Bobbi Brown box at that time. Everybody wanted to work for MAC. It was exciting. It was inclusive. It was the first properly inclusive brand that didn't have to really say that's, everybody just knew. It was so cool.
I wonder if for you, because I felt, obviously I was in London then too and had been for quite a while. London is so, so, so different now, of course. But at that time, what London really was full of outsiders.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was.
Full of people who didn't feel quite right at home and who didn't feel loved or popular or accepted or assimilated or whatever it was. And it was like this kind of melting pot for outcasts in a way.
I think that's absolutely true. Absolutely true. My friend Panda, who was one of the original staffs, she was a first counter staff at
Harvey
Nichols.
Very good makeup artist called Amanda Bowen. You can find her on Instagram. She's very, very good.
Brilliant. And she's great. I mean, when I first met her, she was like a full goth. And I just loved it. I mean, a lot of these people I hadn't really seen before, you know, any of these styles or identities other than just seeing them in the face, or because that was one of the saving graces of my childhood, really, was that my mum got me a subscription to the Face magazine, which came every month, which when you're stuck in your bedroom for your entire life, I devoured it, you know. So I actually had quite a good kind of cultural reference, but not in person. Do you know what I mean? Just from looking at pictures. And then, and we didn't have the internet then. So you just, that's all you had, what you read.
And what did you look like at this point?
So
what was your vibe?
It's quite difficult to think about it. So when I first moved from Norwich, I was kind of a raver. So I had all the John Richmond Destroy stuff.
Yes.
You know, I had like the
sheer sleeves.
Just, all of that stuff, the sheer sleeves. Yeah, absolutely. But when I got to London, I met my mate Katie, who you've met, and we started drinking beer, and we did the All Saints geezer bird look.
Right. Little vests, big trousers.
Totally. Parachute pants, you know, like the jungle ones with all the bits hanging off. So mostly it was that kind of style. We loved trainers. We really liked being comfortable, and we really liked drinking lots and lots of beer. So that was me in the 90s. Then I moved on to wine. Yes, it's marked by alcohol. Quite a lot, the periods.
And what kind of training was that? I always think that makeup artists who come from counter, I always think you can tell.
Yeah.
Because it's a very different job from having extraordinary looking models wheeled in to a studio.
You're working on everyone. You're working on every skin condition, every skin type, every skin colour. There is no training like the kind of training that we got there. Also, we actually had training as well.
Yeah.
You know, you would have monthly updates, you'd have new product training, and you'd have actual sessions where you'd be working with Terry or David or whoever was, you know, in charge of training then. So I feel like, you know, if I meet someone and they worked at MAC back then, I'm like, oh yeah, we just identify, we get it. You talk in product, you talk in code, you know, you talk in colours. But yeah, I mean, it was amazing. I do feel that working on a counter, because you're not dealing with supermodels, are you? You're dealing with normal people who have normal concerns. And if you can troubleshoot those, and if you can give somebody a moment where they just feel really great about themselves, what a wonderful thing to be able to do. You know, yes, it's lovely to be able to do makeup on someone exquisite. I love doing it. And I always used to love seeing my work in print, but it never felt quite as good because I was already cheating at the beginning. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't that hard.
Yeah, they're already gorgeous.
Yes. That's not to say it was ever really that hard. You know, I love my job, and I just see it as a kind of like, okay, let's problem solve this. We'll get to it. You know, my favourite thing would be if someone came in with like dark under eye circles, and the whole MAC team, we'd work together to figure out the correct combination of products, whatever it was. Sometimes it would be like, you know, an NW concealer and then an NC powder. And then, do you know what I mean? And some kind of mix of colour correctors underneath. It was a real team effort. Everybody would be in that store helping each other, and then we'd all be out in daylight checking it with those frying pan mirrors. Do you remember?
Yeah,
it was great.
I know we've talked previously about how you fell into social media, so you're a super early adopter, and I'm only going to condense it because there's just too much other stuff I want to talk to you about. But you had a client who wanted to know how she could achieve what you had achieved on her, so you quickly knocked out a video, put it up on YouTube for her.
Yes.
And then it grew and it grew and it grew. And you didn't mean to be an influencer because the job didn't exist.
No, I didn't. I was heavily pregnant. So with my first pregnancy with Lily in 2004, I taught myself Photoshop, mm-hmm. right? Because I get very bored. And when I can't, I have to do something creative. And when I can't do makeup, at that time, I couldn't because I was like 8.5 months pregnant or whatever. I'll just teach myself something on the computer. And I've always liked the computer because it, again, is escapism for me. So I don't have to be in the present. I can be in this kind of extra place. So when I was pregnant with Olivia in 2008, I had started being on forums. So there were some beauty forums. There was one called ML's Forum, and it was run by an American girl. And I met Lottie Stannard. Mm-hmm. You know Lottie Stannard?
Yeah.
And a lot of other people who have gone on to be on social media who I know from these forums. And the forums were just written word. Mm-hmm. And you could post a picture of your work or whatever. And it was lots of makeup artists uniting to talk about products they liked, blah, blah, blah. It was a very early version of YouTube.
Very industry.
Totally, very industry. And then I was on quite a few. I was on another one for bridal makeup artists, and someone asked me how I do a quick smoky eye because it's just one of my staples. You know I love to do makeup quick. I always think it looks better if you chuck it on.
Yeah.
So I said, I'll tell you what, I'll film it rather than do you a step-by-step. So I filmed it and I just put it on YouTube because it was the only way that I knew how to get that to mm-hmm. her. Mm-hmm. And she, of course, wasn't then the only person that saw it. Lots of other people did. And then there was requests. And I was 8.5 months pregnant, so I had nothing else to do. So I was like, right, we'll just crack on with this because it's quite fun. And it gave me something to do.
So I'm very interested in this. And it does come up. It comes up time and time again. And it's also true of me. How have you ended up doing something so exposing, so front-facing, when you are, by nature, an introverted person who likes being on her own? How did you transition into that very, very public space where literally everyone is looking at you?
I didn't really think about it. And it was a gradual snowball. And it was very exciting to be involved in it. But as I said earlier, I'm in a room on my own. I mean, even when I would do the videos with my sister, which I quite like doing, it took a long time for us to be able to film together because, I mean, I just am critically uncomfortable in those situations. If you put a cameraman in front of me, I can be in tears very quickly. You can, you know, even from us talking here, because I'm so emotional, everything is very close to the surface. The second I'm publicly facing, it's really difficult for me to not make, because makeup is my savior. It's my mm-hmm. safe space, right? Mm-hmm. So everything is very emotional when it's attached to makeup.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a way, I think that social media was a great way to connect with people, but from afar. And also, I think a lot of the people that connected with me get that.
Yeah.
Because if I'm not for everyone.
Yeah.
I'm for people that are also outsiders. People that...
Who don't want to go up to a counter and talk
absolutely.
To somebody.
You know, so I think that really, I mean, when I started doing the Real Technique stuff, it was much more difficult for me because my sister wasn't involved early on. That was much more difficult when I had to do those things on my own. I feel very exposed and it's very hard because I can't do small talk, as you know. But even when Nick was involved, it was still hard for me because things like meetups are so difficult because you have to talk to people and I'm not very good at it, really, unless it's somebody I feel really... And sometimes when people meet you, especially in those early days, as awkward as this sounds to say, people are slightly in awe of you. And so they want you to entertain them. And it's like, Christ, don't come to me for entertainment. I'm really shit at it. Also, I'm absolutely terrible at doing anything that is inauthentic. So then I'm put in a situation where I have to be fun and I'm not fun.
I wonder if your love of makeup stems slightly from that it's a language you can speak without directly
interacting. It's 100% that.
You talk through makeup.
I talk through makeup. Because it's a thing I can talk about that isn't about me or having to talk about whatever, small talk, right? So I just made sure that I'm so good at it and so product knowledgeable that in any situation, if someone asks me what lip liner I should wear or what red lipstick would suit me, I can go bang, 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 bang. And you know what I'm like, because when I talk about makeup, I'm completely confident, right?
Yeah.
It just rolls off the tongue as like, oh, I get this. This is a medium I can completely communicate with everybody in. But otherwise, it's much more, I'm just so private.
When you're doing tutorials, you're always, always constantly having to look at your own face. That's just a fact.
Yes,
that's just
true.
Part of the job.
Yeah.
So you're constant, and I know you, I know you don't give a shit about not having makeup on camera. I know that's just not a thing for you. But nonetheless, you are constantly staring at your own face because otherwise you can't do the job. How is that for you? And has it changed over the years?
I think it has changed over the years. I don't actually really care massively. I don't think I'm a very vain person, although I do care about my appearance. You know, like I've definitely had fillers. I'm always honest about it. I've had Botox previously. You know, I talk about all of those things, and those obviously do come from a place of vanity, but I don't care if anyone sees me without makeup on. I'm fine. You know, so, but I think I did struggle with scrutiny early on.
What kind of scrutiny?
I remember people telling me that my nose wasn't even, and that I should have a nose job. And I know it's
thanks,
ridiculous
dude.
Now, but I had never thought about it before.
Yeah.
I'd never noticed it before.
Yeah.
And so I'd never really... And then I thought, maybe I should, you know. So I think that is a thing that happens. And I did go for a consultation, and the surgeon was like, you probably don't really need that done. I mean, obviously, if I was in Beverly Hills, they would have done it.
But funny with noses, I always think. I mean, look, people have nose jobs and I know it can be absolutely life-changing for them.
Yes.
They've been teased or bullied or they just haven't been happy. And look, I'm all for everything. Get whatever you want done. But I do think noses are funny in that quite often when someone has a nose job, their face doesn't make sense anymore. The maths don't work anymore.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
If it's a very drastic one, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that my journey here, it's been exactly that. It's been a journey to just being like, oh, I don't give a shit. I really don't. Like, actually, I don't. I don't care what anyone says about me. I just don't. I do care what people say about my friends, my husband, my sister, my kids. That shit pisses me off. It makes me quite upset. But I don't care what anyone says about me. They're probably right. I never ever pretend to be a perfect person. I don't think I am.
But to me, that's little Sam talking. So to me, that sounds like little Sam thinking about siblings and mum. Oh, I care about them and it doesn't matter about me. That's what I hear.
Yeah. I think, but also I think that I've never thought of myself as a perfect person. And I'm quite accepting of the fact that I'm not.
Yeah.
I actually quite embrace the fact that I'm not. I've lived a life. I've not been an angel. I've done a lot of things that I would probably change. I've hurt people. I've not been great, you know, but if I was, it would be surprising considering where I've come from. And that's not an excuse. I'm not using
it's just reality.
As an excuse. That is a reality. It's been a long process. It's been a long journey. And it's been some therapy to get to a point where I'm comfortable with who I am, you know, as a person. But who I am physically doesn't even really, it doesn't matter, really. There has been things that do matter. Like I've been so much happier since I had a breast reduction, however many years ago that was. And I think that's because I felt very visible with the boobs.
When you've got big tits, people just look at you.
Completely.
And they do. They're just there, aren't they?
As I said, I didn't like that kind of attention at all. And so once I didn't have them, I felt obviously lighter and more mobile, but also I just felt more invisible. And I quite like that. I've got to say, I quite like getting older and being less visible. Because when we talk about beauty or whatever, I didn't really think of myself as beautiful, but I definitely knew that I was attractive to men because I experienced an awful lot of attention. Some of it was unwanted, some of it was wanted, and some of it, and quite a lot of it, I courted because a lot, I needed that validation because of a place I was in my life, you know. I just needed that validation to feel, I don't know why, but I did. So
I guess if you don't feel worthy of the right kind of attention, you accept the wrong kind, right?
I think so. And I definitely accepted an awful lot of, a lot of my friends were boys, and a lot of those boys behaved very, very badly over years and years and years. I met them at school and they were my friends all the way up until my 40s, actually, until I sort of got depressed. And I accepted a lot of behaviour from them because I was a girl and because I grew up the way that I did. And I just thought it was fine to be treated differently. And actually, one of the things that came out of me too was that I really had a long, hard look at who the people were that were surrounding me and how they behaved.
That's so interesting. So you did an audit. Prompted you to do an audit.
It's not the first time I've done it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think being in beauty, and I have my core friends that I've had for years, you know, my Katie and Nuts, who you've met.
Mm.
But of course, then I met you and I met a few other people that became my very close friends as well. And I suddenly started to develop a really good network of very strong women around me. And my sister and I weren't very close until she was about 20. Until we started doing the YouTube channel, we weren't very close.
Yeah.
Then I just suddenly had this network of very strong women around me and I felt quite supported, but in a different way that I realised, oh, this hasn't been great previously and I haven't had this kind of support and I've been accepting of this kind of behaviour and it's not okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, I did an audit.
Yeah, I mean, the 90s in particular were a stinker for men's behaviour, which isn't to say men don't continue to behave absolutely atrociously, many of them. But the 90s, it was absolutely out in the open and accepted in social situations.
I think it was. And also, I think my behaviour, because I felt that my value was there in being attractive to men, you know, I can't be completely innocent in that, you know, because I don't think that I behaved particularly well. What that comes down to is really that I just don't need that kind of energy in my life. So it was obviously a massive surprise to meet someone so incredible as Ryan, who is a true feminist and really supportive, because it's the first time. I mean, obviously I have other men in my life, like my brothers and the husband of my sister, Ian, and there are, and Brian, my stepfather, there are people along the way, but he is like a true champion of me and what I do. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
There's never any competition.
It's everything.
There. It's absolutely everything.
It's literally everything.
Yeah, yeah. He's the complete backbone.
So you mentioned there your audit in your 40s and you had become depressed. So two major, major life events happened to you in your 40s. You met a very, very good man who you want to share your life with, but also you suffered mental ill health.
Yes.
Kind of almost simultaneously, same period of your life.
Yeah.
Tell me how that affected your self-perception.
What I didn't realise was that I think I had always been depressed.
Yeah.
I think it had always been there. It's like a low-level kind of hum that just goes on in the background, like the hum of a fridge, where you're never quite okay. You're always just a little bit below being present or connected, because you just can't be. And then I think that when I was doing all the stuff with Real Techniques and I was working so hard, and I really was, I just burnt myself out. And somewhere along the line, I just stopped being able to connect at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember it was so difficult because I had my kids and I couldn't enjoy time with them.
Mm.
And I remember being short and I didn't know what was wrong. Mm-hmm. And then Dom, who was my agent back then, who's still a very, very close friend of mine, actually one of the very best men, I forgot to include him. He's brilliant. He said to me, I think that you've got depression and I'm going to make you an appointment at my doctor and you must go. Yeah.
Wow.
It was a lot.
That's an act of care though, isn't it?
It was a lot.
An act of love.
It was so amazing. So he booked me in with his private doctor and in central London, and I just went, and she said, you've got intense anxiety and you have depression. And I was like, I can't be depressed. This isn't what depression feels like. As it turns out, what I thought depression was definitely wasn't what depression actually was.
What was depression?
It's just the inability to be present and to be connected, to be like actually in the moment. I just wasn't there. And it wasn't that I felt sad. I just felt nothing, absolutely nothing about anything. I remember driving the car and thinking, I wasn't ever suicidal, but I think that's called suicidal ideation. I remember driving the car and thinking, I could just drive into that tree.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to do it.
Yeah.
But that had never crossed my mind before.
Yeah. There's a psychiatric theory, which I really, really believe, which is You know, when we go to the top of a tall building, we're not scared of falling. We're scared of jumping.
That's true
of life, right? You're scared that life will get the better of you and you'll do something irreversible and terrible. And there are moments of your life where that becomes really heightened.
I think that completely. And I just reached a pinnacle where I couldn't hold everyone up anymore, even though people weren't asking me to hold them up, because it had been my lifelong thing.
It's your role.
Protecting everyone.
Big sister.
I felt responsible for doing it, you know? Also, because of that, I had picked a series of men who were also, I don't want to include Danny, my ex, because he's really a very great man, but a period of men who I dated, who not everybody online would necessarily know about.
Sure.
Who were there for me to look after them, you know, for the money, or, you know, like they would live in my house, or, and they would not even try to contribute in any way, just like a complete disrespect.
Mm-hmm.
And I just was like, I felt so alone.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not good at talking about those things.
Mm-hmm. Since going through that episode that I know was so, so hard for you, and since meeting a man who does respect you and does value and is so happy with your successes and your happiness, have you found it easier to talk?
Yeah, I talk to Ryan about everything. I do. I think, well, when I actually was diagnosed with the depression and they gave me sertraline, which is an SRRI, mm-hmm. I think that. Mm-hmm. And I was very excited. And I thought, these are going to be happy pills. These are going to be happy.
Send me loony sertraline.
Ooh, yes, right.
Such bad night terrors I had.
It's quite a full-on drug. I sort of expected it to just be like, I'm fine. But actually, it turned out I needed proper therapy for my childhood. So I had therapy. And then just as I was coming out of it, I met Ryan. I was introduced to him on a pub crawl with my friend Luke. He was a friend of Luke's. Luke had just come back from LA where he lives. And we met and we had a bit of a one-night stand. And then
I saw you the next day,
you
mate.
Saw it, absolutely. In the same clothes.
She was wearing the same clothes.
And but I didn't really see it as going anywhere necessarily, because I just got to a point where I was in a really good place and I was like, oh, definitely don't want a relationship.
Yeah.
And then the second date we went on, I was like, oh my God, you're so great. You're so fun. You're brilliant. You're so interesting. And he had all his own stuff going on. And this thing sounds so silly, but I had this Topshop hoop earring, which I'd loved for years, and it just broke on the date. And he just went, give it here. And he just fixed it. And it was such a small thing, but it was the first time someone had done something for me in so long that I was like, oh my God, this is great. This is exciting. Silly things, you know, but when
that's
you're doing everything, you know, and obviously since then he does everything for me.
Yeah.
Absolutely everything.
So quite a lot of big stuff happened at that time.
Yeah.
And one of the very big things that happened was you decided to step back professionally for various boring business reasons that we probably don't need to go into because they're tedious to anyone outside of it. But I know also emotionally that was important for you. You needed to take a step back from social media and from doing what you were doing.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Firstly, as you know, Nick has multiple sclerosis.
Uh-huh.
And we knew that she was struggling more. She was struggling more with her movement. She was finding it very hard to do
a lot of travel.
She was finding it hard to walk in the same way that she had done before. And we also knew that the stem cell treatment wasn't going to be available to her in the UK
mm-hmm.
for various reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially, she wasn't bad enough to require it.
Yeah.
But also, she didn't want to be in a position where she had to be so terrible because you don't get it. You don't get the mobility back. It just stops it progressing.
Yeah.
And so she had decided that she was going to go and have this huge stem cell treatment, which also involves chemo mm-hmm. in Mexico. So we knew that that was going to be some time out. And for some time, I had felt I had outgrown Pixie Woo. And I felt that there was an awful lot of pressure on me to perform and that I didn't like being looked at and watched. And so I just needed some time out. I needed some time out for me. And I just stepped away from everything for a period of time. I needed to, at that time, I didn't want to do makeup. And it's very difficult when your hobby and the thing that you love becomes the thing that you have to do to earn money.
Yeah.
Because then sometimes it takes the love out of it, not for everyone, but it did for me. It made it much more difficult for me to connect with makeup and for it to be my escape because I had to do a certain amount of things. And the further you get on in a company, the more you have to do things that you don't want to do.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm not very good at doing the things that I don't want to do, especially when it comes to saying things I don't want to say, saying things that I don't agree with. I still can't be scripted. I can't have words put in my mouth because it just sounds like it sounds fake and I can't do that. So I felt that I needed to step back from it, and that was the thing to do. And obviously I came back to social media at the beginning of this year because I started enjoying doing makeup again.
Yeah, so two things happened to you physically during that time that I thought were really interesting. So I speak to you all the time, regardless of whether you were working or not. You and I check in a lot. And the first thing that happened is you never had any makeup on. It was like it was a literal cleanse, wasn't it?
Totally.
You just had to stop wearing makeup.
Yeah.
What did that mean to you?
I had to do it because makeup had become a thing that I just was not enjoying.
Yeah.
And so I didn't want to put it on.
Yeah.
And I just enjoyed that not being part of my routine.
Yeah.
I had to do a full detox to actually come back round to it. Makeup is so creative to me, and I just didn't feel very creative at that time.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. You burnt out.
I was completely burnt out,
yeah.
And the other thing you did, as well as stop wear makeup for a while, was you became engaged with fitness for the first time.
Yes.
What has that done for your head and your body, and how has it made you feel?
I did it because I was bored. I was very, very bored, and I just thought, and I had an awful lot of time on my hands, and I was like, well, I've got to do something. What am I going to do? And so, because I also have Hashimoto's, which is a thyroid condition, I have very achy joints, which I don't have anymore since I started fitness.
Mm-hmm.
So I started going to the gym. I started lifting things. I think when I was younger in the 90s, everyone was like, just be thin. Just be thin.
Yeah.
Just go running. Just go jogging. I can't jog because it hurts my joints. Also, it's boring as shit.
Yeah.
Who wants to do that?
I cannot.
I mean, forgive me, anyone that really loves it, but I just can't go to that mental place where you run.
Yeah.
I hate being sweaty. I hate being out of breath. These are not things that work for me. I can't be miserable. I can't do something and pay for something that makes me unhappy. I don't want to do it, right? But I went to the gym and I started lifting things.
Mm-hmm.
And moving things around.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just like I don't ever get out of breath. All I do is go in for an hour every morning, 5 days a week. I have the weekends off. And I just lift things and put them down again. It's great.
You're making it almost sound appealing to me. That's saying something.
It's actually really great, Sal. I mean, I don't want to be that person who...
Well, you have to do what works.
Yeah, but it's been great. It has been, obviously, it has benefits for your mental health, but physically, I don't have any aches and pains anymore.
Mm, that's great.
It's great. Yeah, I really love it.
And you lost a fair amount of weight, which
yes.
I know, I don't think of you as somebody who's particularly engaged in weight as a subject.
No.
It's not something that you and I ever talk about.
No.
Neither of us is particularly interested in it. But suddenly you were... I remember quite clearly you saying, I need to lose some weight.
Well, if you give up work and you sit on the sofa in your pants and eat crisps all day, you are going to put on weight. And, and while I absolutely applaud people that are very comfortable like that, I'm not because it hurts my joints and none of my clothes fit. And quite frankly, I spent an awful lot of money on my clothes when I was depressed and I didn't want to buy a whole new wardrobe. And it just actually pained me looking at the clothes I had going, God, that was a sickening waste of money. So it was either do something about it or buy new clothes. And that just wasn't an option. So I did something about it.
Has moving around helped you mentally?
Yeah, absolutely. It's completely helped me mentally. Where I don't think about things when I'm in there. I just go, I do the stuff, and then I immediately feel better afterwards. And I can eat all the crisps I like.
Yeah. As you mentioned before, you have kids. You have two girls.
Yeah.
And you were on your own with them for a long time, which isn't to say they don't have a dad who's very present.
Yes.
He is. But you lived alone with your girls for a long time. And now your girls are young women, becoming young women. I wonder... Is there a conflict for you as a mum between working in the beauty industry and raising young women? Are there parts of what we do, the world we work in, that make you uncomfortable for them or concerned for them?
I think that not within beauty. I think within the influencer sphere, I went on a bit of a journey with that because I think maybe 5 years ago, influencer stuff got very weird where it suddenly felt really staged. And I was like, oh, God, people actually think of me as being an influencer. And I never thought of myself as an influencer, even though I don't even like the word, obviously, but even though clearly I had some influence, I always thought of myself as doing other people's makeup before doing my own, right? So I think that when it got so money orientated and so narcissistic, I felt a little bit more uncomfortable with it with my kids. But actually, they don't give a shit. They don't care at all. They only ever tuned into beauty tutorials to watch the Americans fight and have drama. Ever. They don't. They genuinely don't care. They think I don't know anything about beauty. Like, I'm an absolute idiot as far as they're concerned. So fine. I'm fine with it. They're absolutely fine. They sit on their TikTok, you know, listen to the same song all day. They love it. They just consume media in a different way.
Yeah.
To how we do, but they're not interested in beauty.
What do you hope for them about how they, as women, see themselves in comparison to how we did?
I think we're in a different world now, and I think a lot of that is actually down to social media. We're in a different world where it's not acceptable to have a brand without considering all skin tones. It's not acceptable to shame someone for what weight they are or what dress size they are. And that's really exciting. And I see that reflected a lot in my kids, because I spent a lot of my time as a young person wanting to be thinner because of the models that I saw who I was absolutely mm-hmm. obsessed with, mm-hmm. but also having those massive boobs and feeling like I didn't actually fit in, not really quite knowing. Because actually in the 90s, if you had no boobs, you were cool. If you had boobs,
you were sexy. Yeah.
Right. And I never wanted to be that, but I felt like I've sort of thrust into that role. So I just played it, you know. But I think for the girls now, and I don't know about the boys, but I expect the same. I think they have much more control over those things.
You were Kate Moss or Sam Fox, weren't you?
100%.
Basically.
Yeah.
Those were the archetypes.
There was a moment, maybe it was 2 years ago, where I was walking behind Lily. We were walking somewhere in the city, and she turned around, she looked at me, and she went, "Does my bum look big in this?" And I was like, oh my God, what's the right answer? Because her bum did look big in it. And I was like, yes, it does. And she went, "Correct answer, Mum." And I was like, oh my God.
Well, we were kids, that would have been a nightmare.
I mean, she's got this wonderful, wonderful ass. And I'm like in awe of it. And she is too. My kids love their bodies. And it's quite amazing to see that, because I never felt like that about myself.
Yeah. I wonder now, when you've been through all of this stuff, which isn't to say, you know, mental ill health begins and ends in this sort of linear way. Of course, of course, we kind of go in waves, and I'm not saying it's all over. But now you're in a better place and you're in a great marriage and you're in a good marriage with yourself. How do you take time for you? How do you relax? How do you unwind?
Ah, well, I got back into makeup. So I got a studio. I love this little studio. It's a horrible little box room, but it has all of my stuff in it. And it's such a safe space for me. So I go to the gym and then I go to my office. And sometimes I just sit there and look at things and think about things. And sometimes I just do makeup and I don't film it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I do makeup and I do film it. Mm-hmm. But it's just such a nice place to kind of gradually get yourself back into that again. So I'm really enjoying that. And I think the gym and working again, but under my own terms, has really helped. I love it. I feel like I feel like I'm back.
I've got to get a little product moment in there, because I know people will want to know. So name me five things that you have emptied at least five times in your life and continue to use.
Oh, gosh, this is so hard. So it's very difficult. This is so difficult. NYX, Lifton, Snatch, horrible name. I just can't.
The brow pen.
The brow pen.
I mean, I use it all the time. I love it so much.
I whiz through it. And the thing is, I mean, I always loved the MAC Shape and Shade, but this one hasn't got the horrible, useless bit on the end that you don't use, right? Yeah. And it's cheap. And so I just whiz through it. I use that all the time. I use a lot the Dr. Sam's Flawless Lip, the lanolin. It's just lanolin and ceramide, mm-hmm. right? It's a lip balm. But I have this very annoying thing where I get a watery eye.
And same.
This watery eye could last weeks. And then it gets sore, so it won't stop watering. The only thing that works is this lip balm. I just put it on the corner of my eye.
Oh, right.
What? I know.
Because I am an eye waterer, yes, as you know.
Try it.
Once it starts, you can't turn the bloody thing off.
I put a tiny little dot just on the corner of my outside eye, and it just...
So it acts as a dam and a soother of the skin.
100%. It's a game changer. And it's a lip balm. but I use it for the eyes. But it's a lip balm. Also, I mean, lanolin's a fab product,
yeah,
unless you're allergic to it.
Yeah.
So I'll use it on my eyebrows and everything. I mean, I'm like, I love it. What else do I use? I mean, Olaplex, obviously. I get through the Olaplex. I'm obviously missing something really key that I always, always use.
Anything from MAC days?
I mean, obviously, I've been through so many MAC things. Face and body. So many face and bodies.
Me too.
Oh, it's just, I never think of MAC as being like skin, apart from obviously the concealer, the shade range, but also face and body, it's just the best.
I always think if you don't know what to use, just use face and body.
Totally.
If I can't really engage with what I'm doing, I just think, well, I'll just wear face and body.
I love it, but I do feel quite differently about MAC to how I used to feel about it. It just feels like a very different brand to me now. I feel disengaged from it, like it doesn't really belong to me anymore, you know?
Skincare?
Skincare. So, I have been using the Karen Bartoff Peel and Glow and the other one, the serum. So I've been through that twice now.
We've both recently had facials with Karen Bartoff and she is astonishing.
I am astonished. I'm genuinely astonished.
Well, she changed the shape of my face.
I literally came out
of the facial and I had a different shaped face in a very good way, I hasten to add.
I feel like I can't ever have another facial anywhere else.
She's astonishing.
But also, calling it a facial doesn't do it justice.
No, that's true.
Because really, it involves all these incredible machines that, you know, can... laser that can take off your pigment, that works on, you know, anti-aging, all sorts of things. And it is so amazing. I honestly was, you know, that scene in Death Becomes Her where she goes, yeah, I'm a girl. I was like that.
Yeah.
It's brilliant.
Yeah. I knew you'd love it. I kept saying, Sam, you've got to go. It's amazing. Right. It's amazing.
So you and Joe Jones were hassling me to go for this thing and I never, ever go for anything because I'm like, right, I just can't
I'm the same.
I can't be arsed. But you kept going on about it. And then my sister went and I was like, oh God, now I've got FOMO. I have to go. And I'm glad I did because now I feel like I'm going to do that forever.
We'll put Karen Bartoff's details in the show notes as well as all the product stuff. Finally, I want to know, nowadays, yes, Sam Chapman, in your mid-40s, how do you feel when you look in the mirror?
I'm going to sound massively conceited, but I think I look better than I ever looked.
I think you're right.
I feel really good about where I am emotionally, although probably you all think that I'm a bit nuts from this podcast because I'm always on the brink, but I'm very happy. I look in the mirror and I'm just happy with who I am.
Yeah.
And I think when you get to a certain age, you stop sort of accepting bullshit people and bullshit things in your life. You're then like, oh, I just don't accept those things anymore, right? So you're able to just detach from caring about other people's opinions of you. And I'm not talking about like your good friends. If my good friend said, you've really hurt my feelings, I'd be devastated.
Sure.
But I don't care massively what somebody thinks about me that I've never met before, just based on the fact that they've watched a 10-minute video of me, because actually I know I'm a good person. I know that I can be a massive laugh, catch me in the right moment, you know. I know I'm generous. You know, I know loads of things about myself that I'm really confident in.
Mm-hmm.
I also have a husband who's really, really happy with me.
Yeah.
And so I don't feel like probably when I was younger, I definitely would look just to see if people were looking at me, you know, like I needed that validation. I just never, ever think about it now. Like I might see a good looking guy in the street or a good looking girl and I'll look at them and I'll be like, wow, what a lovely face. Or, oh my God, you look really fit. And I have this appreciation for people, but I just don't feel like I'm there kind of courting it or any of those things. So for me, yes, I'm very happy with where I am. I'm very happy when I look in the mirror because I work really hard now to be fitter and stronger. But also mostly I'm really happy because I'm really happy with where I am in my life and who I am and who I have around me.
I'm happy with where you are and who you are.
Thanks, Sal.
I'm proud of you.
It's been a journey. I mean, I've known you since, I mean, probably maybe we met at that dinner with Georgie Dawson at that Italian, didn't we?
God.
Or did we meet in New York?
Did we meet in New York
when you were interviewing
with Katie? I was with Katie Jane Hughes.
Yes.
That's right. And we all had drinks then. I met Nick first.
Yes, I met Nick before you. Yeah.
Yeah. No, we met in New York and we've been friends ever since. And I just think I've always loved you, but you've changed so much in yourself and it's a joy. It's a joy to see you so content and so happy.
Yeah, I'm definitely less guarded, I would say. than I was before. And I'm definitely more confident with my own voice than I was before, I think.
Well, thank you for letting down what remains of your guard here on the podcast. I'm so chuffed to have had you. Thank you so much for being so real, as always. And thank you all so much for listening. If you enjoyed my conversation with Sam Chapman today, please do give us a rating and a review wherever you get your podcasts. And please come back for another episode and another guest next time. Lots of love. Bye.
Insanity Group.